Maybe the radiation caused it. But he'd noticed a similar scab-like growth, also the size of a dime, on Roland's chin. Skin cancer, he thought. Well, he would take the straight razor and slice them off when he shaved, and that would be the end of it. His hide was too tough for skin cancer. But it was strange, he thought, that the little round scabs were only on his face, not his hand or his arms or anywhere else, just his face. He heard a knock on the trailer door and he left the bathroom to answer it. Roland and Laurie, both carrying rifles, had returned from the recon mission they'd been on with three other able-bodied soldiers. Last night, one of the perimeter sentries had seen the flicker of lights to the south, 3 or 4 miles across the desert. "Two trailers," Laurie reported, trying not to stare too hard at the Nazi uniform the colonel wore. Kempka had always been too fat to squirm into it. "Pulled by a Chevy van and a Pontiac, all the vehicles look in pretty good shape." "How many people?" Macklin asked, opening one of the jugs of bottled water and offering it to Laurie.
"We saw 16 people," Roland told him. "6 women, 8 men, and 2 children. They seem to have plenty of gas, food, and water, but all of them are burn scarred. 2 of the men can hardly walk."
"They have guns?"
"Yes, sir."
Roland took the jug of water from Laurie and drank. He thought the uniform looked wonderful on the king, and he wished there'd been one his size to wear. He couldn't remember much of what had happened that night with Freddy Kempka, but he recalled having a vivid dream in which he killed Mike Armbruster. "One of the men had a rifle." "Just one rifle? Why do you think they haven't come here? You know they've seen our lights."
"They might be afraid," Roland said. "They might think we'll take what they have."
Macklin took the jug back, recapped it, and set it aside. A door opened and closed, and Sheila Fontana walked through the corridor into the room. She stopped short when she saw the uniform. "We could use the trailers and the vehicles," Macklin decided. "But we don't need anybody with burn marks. I don't want anybody with burn marks in our camp."
"Colonel, there are already about 30 or more people here who were burned in, you know," Lowry said. "I mean, what does it matter?"
"I've thought a lot about this, Corporal Lowry," he replied, and though he had not, it sounded impressive. "I think people with burn marks, keloids," he said, remembering the technical name of atomic-induced burns, "are detrimental to the morale of our camp. We don't need to be reminded of ugliness, do we? And people with burn marks are not going to keep themselves as clean as the rest of us because they're ashamed of the way they appear and they're already demoralized." He found himself staring at the scab on Roland's chin. It was the size of a quarter. Hadn't it been smaller just a few days ago? His gaze shifted. There were 3 other small scabs at Roland's hairline. "People with burns are going to be disease spreaders," he told Corporal Lowry. He looked over Lowry's face but saw none of the scabs. "We're going to have enough trouble as it is keeping disease out of our camp. So, in the morning, I want you to round up the ones with the burn scars and take them out of the camp. I don't want them returning. Understand?" Lowry started to smile because he thought the colonel was kidding. But Macklin's blue eyes bored into him.
"Sir, you don't mean kill all of them, do you?"
"Yes, that's what I mean."
"But why not just banish them? I mean, tell them to go somewhere else."
"Because," Roland Croninger, who saw to the heart of the matter, said,
"they won't go anywhere else. At night, they'll slip back into camp and try to steal food and water. They might help the dirt warts attack us."
"Right," Macklin agreed. "And that's the new law of this camp. No one is admitted who has burn marks. And you will take those others out in the morning, and they will not come back. Roland'll go with you."
"I can do it myself."
"Roland will go with you," Macklin said, quietly but firmly. And Judd Lowry looked at the floor. "Now, another thing.
I want you to organize a work detail in the morning and distribute some of this to my people. He nodded toward the cartons of soft drinks, potato chip bags, cookies, and cakes. My people, he realized he'd said. I want them to be happy. Do that after you've finished the first duty. What about those people with the trailers out there? Macklin deliberated. Oh, he thought, the Shadow Soldier was going to be so proud of him.
How many soldiers do you need to go out and take those vehicles? He asked.
I don't know. Maybe 4 or 5, I guess.
Good. Then go out and bring them back, but not the people. We don't need people who aren't healthy.
What do we need the trailers for? Sheila asked. We're okay as we are. She couldn't bear to look at Judd Lowry's face because he haunted her nightmares along with an infant that kept crying. A decayed corpse named Rudy crawled through the dust in her dreams right up into her bed, and she thought she was going crazy.
Because, Macklin said, turning toward her, we're not going to stay here forever. As soon as we get organized and healthy, as soon as we get our morale high, we're moving out.
Moving out, she laughed. Moving to where, war hero? The fucking moon?
No. Across the country, maybe east. We can forage as we go.
You mean everybody moving east? What the hell for? Where is there to go?
The cities, Macklin answered, or what's left of them. The towns, the villages, we can build our own cities if we please. We can start to put things back together again like they should have been in the first place before this shit happened.
You've cracked, friend, Sheila said. It's over. Can't you dig it?
It's not over. It's just beginning. We can build things back, but better than they were. We can have law and order, and we can enforce the laws.
What laws? Yours? The kids? Who's gonna make the laws?
The man with the most guns, Roland said.
Colonel Macklin turned his attention back to Judd Lowry.
You're dismissed, he said. Have the trailers here within 2 hours.
Lowry left the trailer. Outside, he grinned at the night sky and shook his head.
The soldier shit had gone to the colonel's brain. But maybe he was right about getting rid of everybody who had burn scars. Lowry didn't like looking at those burns and being reminded of the Holocaust anyway. The burn marks were ugly. Keep America beautiful, he thought. Kill a Scarface today.
He walked on into the camp to select 4 men for the mission, but he knew it would be a piece of cake. He'd never felt so important in his life. Before the disaster, he'd just been a clerk in a gun store, and now he was a corporal in Colonel Macklin's army. This was like waking up in a new skin.
It's not over, Colonel Macklin had said. It's just beginning.
Lowry liked the ring of that.
In the Airstream trailer, Sheila Fontana approached Macklin and looked him up and down. She saw the Nazi swastika on several of the badges he was wearing.
What are we going to start calling you, Adolf?
Macklin's hand came out and caught her chin. His eyes flared angrily, and she realized she'd gone too far. The strength in that hand felt like it was about to crack her jaw.
If you don't like something here, he told her quietly, you know where the door is. And if you don't watch your mouth, I'll throw you to the dirt warts. Oh, I'm sure they'd love to have company. Aren't you, Roland?
Roland shrugged. He could see that the king was hurting Sheila, and that bothered him. Macklin released her.
You're a fool, he said. You don't see what could be, do you?
Sheila rubbed her jaw. Man, the game is done. You're talking rebuilding and all that crap? We're lucky to have a pot to piss in.
You'll see. His gaze searched her face for the small scabs. I've got plans, important plans. You'll see.
He found no evidence of the cancers on Sheila's face. She'd noted his roving eyes. What's wrong?
I washed my hair yesterday.
Wash it again, he said. It stinks.
He looked at Roland. A sudden inspiration struck him.
The Army of Excellence, he said. How does that sound?
Fine, Roland liked it. There was a sweeping, grand, Napoleonic sound to it. It's good.
The Army of Excellence, Macklin repeated.
We've got a long way to go. We're going to have to find more able-bodied men and women. We'll need more vehicles, and we'll have to carry our food and water with us. We can do it if we put our minds and our muscles to the job. His voice rose with excitement. We can build things back, but better than they ever were.
Sheila thought he was off his bird. The Army of Excellence, my ass. But she held her tongue, figuring it was best to just let Macklin blow off steam.
People will follow me,
he continued. As long as I give them food and protection, they'll follow me and they'll do whatever I say. They don't have to love me, they don't even have to like me, but they'll follow me all the same because they'll respect me. Isn't that right?
He asked Roland.
Yes, sir, the boy answered. People want to be told what to do. They don't want to make the decisions.
Behind his goggles, Roland's eyes had begun to glint with excitement as well. He could see the vast picture the king was painting.
A massive army of excellence, moving across the land on foot, in cars and in trailers, overrunning and absorbing other encampments and communities, swelling stronger, but only with healthy, unmarked men and women who were willing to rebuild America. He grinned.
Oh, what a game of King's Knight this has turned out to be.
People will follow me, Colonel Macklin said, nodding. I'll make them follow me. I'll teach them all about discipline and control, and they'll do anything I say, right?
His eyes blazed at Sheila. She hesitated. Both the war hero and the kid were watching her. She thought of her warm bed, all the food and the guns that were here. And then she thought of the old cold dirtwort land and the things that slithered in the dark.
Right, she said. Anything you say.
Within 2 hours, Lowry and his raiding party returned with the Chevy van, the Pontiac, and the 2 trailers. The small camp was taken by surprise, and there'd been no wounds or casualties to Macklin's Army of Excellence. Lowry delivered several knapsacks full of canned goods and more bottled water, plus 3 cans of gasoline and a carton of engine oil. He emptied his pockets of wristwatches, diamond rings, and a money clip full of 20s and 50s. Macklin let him keep one of the watches and told him to distribute extra rations to the rest of the raiding party. The largest of the diamond rings he offered to Sheila Fontana, who stared at it for a moment as it glittered on Macklin's palm, and then took it from him. It was inscribed, "From Daniel to Lisa, Love Forever." Only after she put it on and was admiring it by the lamplight did she realize that grains of dried blood were stuck down in the setting, giving the diamonds a dirty cast. Roland found a road map of Utah on the rear floorboard of the Buick, and from the glove compartment he retrieved several flare pens and a compass. He gave all the booty to the king, and Macklin rewarded him with one of the medals adorned with a swastika. Roland immediately pinned it on his shirt. In the lamplight, Colonel Macklin spread the road map out on the table in his command headquarters and sat down to study it. After a few moments of silent deliberation, he picked up a red flare pen and began to draw a jagged arrow pointing east.
"My main man," the shadow soldier said, leaning over Macklin's shoulder.
And in the morning, under thick gray clouds scudding slowly eastward, Roland and Lowry and 10 hand-picked soldiers escorted 36 burn-scarred men, women, and children out to the edge of the dirtwort land. After the shooting was over, the dirtworts emerged from their holes and scuttled forward to claim the corpses.
Chapter 45.
Swan and Josh had been following the railroad tracks through a Nebraska dust storm for 3 days when they found the wrecked train. They didn't see the train until they were almost upon it, and then there it was. Railroad cars scattered everywhere, some of them riding piggyback. Most of the cars were broken to pieces except for a caboose and a couple of freight cars. Swan slid down off Mule, following Josh as he walked carefully over the debris.
"Watch out for nails," he warned her, and she nodded.
Killer had been turned the color of chalk by all the dust, and he advanced before Josh, sniffing warily at the splintered planks under his paws. Josh stopped, shielding his eyes from the dust with one hand, and he looked up at the side of a freight car. The storm had almost scoured all the paint off, but he could still make out a faded panorama of clowns, lions, and three rings under a big top. Scrolled red letters spelled out, "Rydell Circus, Inc."
"It's a circus train," he told Swan. "Probably going somewhere to set up when it got knocked off the tracks."
He motioned toward the caboose.
"Let's see what we can find."
For the past 3 nights, they'd slept in barns and deserted farmhouses, and once the railroad tracks had taken them out to the outskirts of a moderate-sized town, but the wind brought such a smell of decay from the town that they dared not enter it. They'd circled the town, picking up the tracks on the other side and continuing across the open plains. The caboose door was unlocked. It was gloomy within, but at least it was shelter. Josh figured both the horse and terrier could fend for themselves, and he stepped in. Swan followed, closing the door behind her. Josh bumped into a small desk, making little bottles and jars clink. The air was warmer the further he went, and he made out the shape of a cot to his right. His groping fingers touched warm metal, a cast-iron freestanding stove.
"Somebody's been here," he said. "Hasn't been very long, either."
He found the grate and opened it. Inside, a few coals had burned down to ashes, and an ember glowed like a tiger's eye. He continued to feel his way around the caboose, almost tripping over a bundle of blankets lying in a corner, and made his way back to the desk. His eyes were getting used to the dim yellow murk that came through the caboose's filmy windows, and he discovered a half-burned candle stuck with wax to a saucer. Near it was a box of kitchen matches. He struck one and lit the candle's wick, and the light spread. Swan saw what appeared to be crayons and lipsticks atop the desk. A curly red wig sat on a wig stand. In front of the desk's folding metal chair was a wooden box about the size of a shoebox, decorated with little intricately carved lizards. Their tiny eyes were formed of multifaceted glass, and they sparkled in the candlelight. Next to the cot, Josh found an open bag of gravy-trained dog food and a plastic jug that sloshed when he nudged it with his foot. Swan stepped closer to the stove. On a wall rack were gaudy suits with spangles, oversized buttons, and floppy lapels. There was a pile of newspapers, shards of timber and coals ready for the fire. She looked toward the far corner where the bundle of blankets lay. Except there was something else over there, too, something only half covered by the blankets.
"Josh," she pointed, "what's that?"
He brought the candle over. The light fell on the rigid smile of a clown's face. At first, Josh was startled, but then he realized what it was.
"A dummy. It's a life-size dummy."
The thing was sitting up with white grease paint on its face and bright red lips. A green wig was perched on its scalp, and its eyelids were closed. Josh leaned forward and poked the dummy's shoulder. His heart kicked. He gingerly touched the thing's cheek and smeared off some of the grease paint. Under it was sallow flesh. The corpse was cold and stiff and had been dead at least 2 or 3 days. Behind them, the caboose door suddenly swung open, letting in a whirlwind of dust. Josh spun around, stepping in front of Swan to shield her from whoever or whatever was coming in. He saw a figure standing there, but dust in his eyes blinded him. The figure hesitated. In one hand was a shovel. There was a long, tense silence, and then the man in the doorway said,
"Howdy," in a thick western drawl. "You folks been here long?"
He closed the door, shutting off the storm. Josh watched him warily as the man walked across the caboose, his cowboy boots clomping on the planked floor, and leaned the shovel against a wall. Then the man untied a bandana from around his nose and mouth.
"Well, can you two speak English, or am I going to have to do all the talking?"
He paused a few seconds, then answered himself in a high, mocking voice.
"Yes, sir, we surely do speak English, but our eyeballs are about to bug out of our heads, and if we flap our tongues, they'll go flying out like fried eggs."
He pronounced it eggs.
"We can speak," Josh replied. "It's just, you surprised us."
"Reckon I did. But the last time I walked out that door, Leroy was alone, so I'm a mite surprised myself." He took off his cowboy hat and swatted it against one denim-covered thigh. Dust welled into the air.
"That's Leroy," he motioned toward the clown in the corner. "Leroy Satterwaite. He died a couple of nights ago, and he was the last of them. I've been out digging a hole for him."
"The last of them?" Josh prompted.
"Yep. Last of the circus people. One of the best clowns you ever laid your eyes on. Man, he could have made a stone crack a grin."
He sighed and shrugged.
"Well, it's over now. He was the last of them. Except me, I mean."
Josh stepped toward the man and held the candle and saucer out to illuminate his face. The man was thin and lanky, his scraggly, grizzled face as long and narrow as if it had been pressed in a vise. He had curly, light brown hair spilling over his high forehead, almost to his bushy brown eyebrows. Beneath them, his eyes were large and liquid, a shade between hazel and topaz. His nose was long and thin, in keeping with the rest of them, but it was the mouth that was the centerpiece of his face. The lips were thick, rubbery folds of flesh, designed to pull miraculous mugs and grins. Josh hadn't seen such a pair of lips since he'd been served a big-mouth bass in a restaurant in Georgia. The man wore a dusty denim jacket, obviously much used and abused, a dark blue flannel shirt and jeans. His lively, expressive eyes moved from Josh to Swan, lingered a few seconds, then returned to Josh.
"Name's Rusty Weathers," he said.
"Now, who in blazes are you? And how'd you get out here?"
"My name is Josh Hutchins, and this is Swan Prescott. We haven't had any food or water in 3 days. Can you help us?"
Rusty Weathers nodded toward the plastic jug.
"Help yourselves. That's water from a creek a couple of hundred yards from the tracks. Can't say how clean it is, but I've been drinking it for about..."
He frowned, walked over to the wall, and felt for the notches he'd carved there with his penknife. He ran a finger along them.
41 days, give or take.
Josh opened the jug, sniffed at it, and took a tentative swallow. The water tasted oily, but otherwise okay. He drank again and gave the jug to Swan.
"Only food I've got left is gravy train," Rusty said. "Fella and his wife had a dog act, jumped French poodles through hoops and all."
He plopped the cowboy hat on top of the red wig, pulled the folding chair to him, turned it around and sat down with his arms crossed on the backrest.
"Been a time, I'll tell you. Train was moving pretty as you please 1 minute. The next minute, the sky looked like the inside of a mine shaft, and the wind started whipping cars right off the tracks. We get twisters back in Oklahoma, but damned if this wasn't the granddaddy of them all."
He shook his head, rattling loose the memories.
"You got any cigarettes?"
"No, sorry."
"Damn. Man, I could just about eat a carton of smokes right now."
He narrowed his eyes, examining both Josh and Swan in silence.
"You two look like you've been stomped by a few dozen Brahma bulls. You hurtin'?" Not anymore, Josh said.
What's going on out there?
There ain't been another train along this track in 41 days. The dust just keeps on blowing. What's happening?
Nuclear war. I think the bombs fell just about everywhere. Probably hit the cities first. From what we've seen so far, I don't think there's much left.
Yeah, Rusty nodded, his eyes vacant. I kind of figured it must be that. A few days after the wreck, me and some of the others started walking, trying to find help. Well, the dust was a lot thicker and the wind stronger back then, and we made it about 50 feet before we had to come back. So we sat down to wait, but the storm didn't stop, and nobody came. He stared at a window. Nicky Rinaldi, the lion tamer, and Stan Tambrello decided to follow the tracks. That was a month ago. Leroy was busted up inside, so I stayed here with him and Roger. All of us were clowns, see? The Three Musketeers, oh, we put on a good show. We really made them laugh. His eyes teared up suddenly, and it was a moment before he could speak again. Well, he said finally, me and the others who were left started digging graves. The wreck killed a lot of folks outright, and there were dead animals all over the place. Dead elephants lying up the tracks a ways. But he's all dried up now. Man, you couldn't believe what that smelled like. But who in hell's got the strength to dig a grave for an elephant? We got a regular circus cemetery not too far from here. He nodded vaguely off to the right. Dirt softer once you get away from the tracks. I'd managed to find some of my gear, and I moved in here with Leroy, Roger, and a few of the others. Found my makeup case. He touched the wooden box with its carved creeping lizards. Found my magic jacket, too. A finger hooked toward the rack where the clothes hung. I wasn't hurt too bad, just bruises on bruises, and this. He lifted that big upper lip to display the space where a front tooth had been knocked out. But I was okay. Then, everybody started dying. He sat looking at the candle. It was the damnedest thing, he said. People who were fine one day were dead the next. One night, his eyes glazed over like pond ice, and the memories had him again. One night, we were all sleeping, and I woke up cold. The stove was gone, and the caboose was warm, but I was shivering. And I swear to God, I knew the shadow of death was here, moving from person to person, figuring out who to take next. I think whatever it was passed near enough to me to freeze my bones, and then it moved on. And then daylight came. Roger was dead with his eyes open, and he'd been telling jokes the day before. You know what that crazy Leroy says? He says, Rusty, let's you and me put a happy face on that sumbitch before we send him off. So we painted him up, but it wasn't a disrespectful thing. Oh, no. Rusty shook his head. We loved that old scutter. We just gave him the face he was most comfortable wearing. Then me and Eddie Roscoe carried him out and buried him. Seems like I helped dig 100 graves in a week's time, until it was just me and Leroy. He smiled faintly, looking past Swan and Josh into the corner. Looking good, old buddy. Hell, I thought I'd have been the one long gone before now.
There's no one else here but you? Swan asked.
Just me. I'm the last of the Rydell Circus. He looked at Josh. Who won?
Who won what?
The war. Who won the war, us or the Russians?
I don't know. If Russia looks anything like what Swan and I have seen, God help those people, too.
Well, you gotta fight fire with fire, Rusty said. That's something my mama used to tell me. Fight fire with fire. So maybe there's one good thing about this. Maybe everybody shot all their bombs and missiles off and there ain't any more. The fires just fought it out. And the old world's still here, ain't it?
Yes, Josh agreed. The world's still here. And so are we.
I reckon the world's going to be a mite changed, though. I mean, if everywhere is like here, I believe the luxuries of life are going to be suffering some.
Forget luxuries, Josh told him. This caboose and that stove are luxuries, friend.
Rusty grinned, showing the hole where his tooth had been.
Yep. I got a real palace here, don't I?
He gazed at Swan for a few seconds, then got up, went to the rack, and took from its hanger a black velvet suit jacket. He winked at her, shrugged out of his denim jacket, and put on the one made of black velvet. In the breast pocket was a white handkerchief.
I'll tell you what's still here, too. Something that'll never change, little lady. Magic. You believe in magic, hon?
Yes, she said.
Good.
He whipped the white handkerchief out, and suddenly, there was a bouquet of brightly colored paper flowers in his hand. He offered them to Swan.
You look like a lady who might appreciate some pretty flowers. Course, we'd better water them, too. If flowers don't get their water, they might just swoon away.
He thrust his other hand forward, snapped his wrist in the air, and he was holding a small red plastic pitcher. He tipped it over the flowers, but instead of water, a trickle of yellow dust came out and floated to the floor.
Oh,
Rusty said, feigning disappointment. Then his eyes brightened.
Well, maybe. That's magic dust, little lady.
Sure, magic dust will keep flowers alive just as good as water will. What do you think?
Even though the corpse in the corner gave her the creeps, Swan had to smile.
Sure, she said. I bet it will, too.
Rusty waved his slim hand in the air before Swan's face. She suddenly saw a red ball appear between the first and second fingers, and then another ball seemingly grow between his thumb and forefinger. He took one ball in each hand and began tossing them up in the air from hand to hand.
Think we're missing something, don't you?
He asked her. And when the balls were in midair, he reached with his right hand toward Swan's ear. She heard a soft pop, and his hand withdrew with a third red ball. He juggled the three of them back and forth.
There you go. Knew I'd find that thing somewhere.
She felt her ear.
How'd you do that?
Magic, he explained.
He plopped one ball in his mouth, then the second and third. His empty hand caressed the air, and Swan saw Rusty's throat gulp as he swallowed the balls.
Mighty tasty, he said. Want to try 'em?
He offered his palm to her. In it were the three red balls.
I saw you eat them, Swan exclaimed.
Yep, I did. These are three more. That's what I've been living on, see? Gravy train and magic balls.
His smile faltered, began to fade. His eyes flickered over toward the corpse, and he put the three balls in his pocket.
Well, he said, I reckon that's enough magic for one day.
You're pretty good, Josh said. So you're a clown, a magician, and a juggler. What else do you do?
Oh, I used to ride broncos in the rodeos.
He took off the velvet jacket and hung it up like putting an old friend to bed.
Used to be a rodeo clown. Used to short-order cook in a carnival. Worked on a cattle ranch once. Jack of all trades and master of none, I reckon. But I've always loved magic.
Hungarian magician name of Fabrioso took me under his wing when I was 16 and taught me the craft. Back when I was shilling with the carny. Said I had hands that could either pick pockets or pull dreams out of the air. Rusty's eyes danced with the light.
That Fabrioso was something else, I'll tell you. He talked to the spirits, and they sure enough answered him and did what he said, too.
Is this magic, too?
Swan touched the wooden box covered with lizards.
That was Fabrioso's box of tricks. I keep my makeup and stuff in it now. Fabrioso got it from a magician in Istanbul. Know where that is?
Turkey.
And that magician got it from one in China, so I reckon it kind of has a history.
Like Crybaby does,
Swan said, and she held up the dousing rod.
crybaby. That's what you call that dowser?
A woman. Josh hesitated. The loss of Leona Skelton was still too raw. A very special woman gave that to Swan.
Did Fabrioso give you the magic jacket? Swan asked.
No, I bought that in a magic store in Oklahoma City. But he gave me the box and one other thing.
He unlatched and opened the carved box. Inside were jars, crayons, and rags smeared with 1,000 colors. He dug down toward the bottom.
Fabrioso said this came with the box in a set, so it was right that it went where the box did. Here it is.
He withdrew his hand. In it was a simple oval mirror, framed in black with a scuffed black handle. There was only one ornamentation. Where the handle was attached to the mirror were two small black mask-like faces peering in opposite directions. The glass was a smoky color, streaked and stained.
Fabrioso used this to put on his stage makeup. There was a note of awe in Rusty's voice. He said it showed a truer picture than any mirror he'd ever looked into. I don't use it, though. The glass has gone too dull.
He held it out to Swan, and she took it by the handle. The thing was as light as a buttermilk biscuit.
Fabrioso was 90 when he died, and he told me he got the mirror when he was 17. I'll bet it's 200 years old if it's a day.
Wow.
Something that old was beyond Swan's comprehension. She peered into the glass, but could see her face there only dimly, as if through a curtain of mist. Even so, the burn marks still jarred her, and there was so much dust on her face she thought she resembled a clown herself. She was never going to get used to not having hair, either. She looked closer. On her forehead were two more of those strange dark wart-like things she'd noticed at Leona's. Had those always been there, or had they just come up?
I guess Fabrioso was kind of vain, Rusty admitted. I used to catch him looking in that mirror all the time, except he was usually holding it at arm's length, like this.
He stuck his own hand in front of his face, as if his palm were a looking glass. Swan thrust her arm out. The mirror was aimed at the left side of her face and her left shoulder. Now her head was only an outline in the glass.
I can't see myself like...
There was a movement in the glass, a quick movement, and not her own. A face with an eye in the center of its head, a gaping mouth where the nose should have been, and skin as yellow as dried-up parchment paper rose behind her left shoulder like a leprous moon. Swan dropped the mirror. It clinked to the floor, and she spun around to her left. There was no one there, of course.
Swan?
Rusty had gotten to his feet.
What is it?
Josh put the candle and saucer aside and laid his hand on Swan's shoulder. She pressed into his side, and he could feel her racing heartbeat. Something had scared the stew out of her. He leaned over and picked up the mirror, expecting it to be shattered to pieces, but it was still whole. Looking into the glass, he was repelled by his own face, but he lingered long enough to see that there were four new warts on his chin. He handed the mirror back to Rusty.
Good thing it didn't break. I guess that would have been 7 years bad luck.
I saw Fabrioso drop it 100 times. Once, he flung it down as hard as he could on a concrete floor. It didn't even crack. See, he used to tell me this mirror was magic, too. Only he didn't really understand it, so he never told me why he thought it was magic.
Rusty shrugged.
I just think it looks like a smoky old glass, but since it went with the box, I decided to hold on to it.
He turned his attention to Swan, who still stared uneasily at the mirror.
Don't fret. Like I say, the thing won't break. Hell, it's stronger than plastic.
He laid the mirror down on the tabletop.
You okay?
Josh asked. She nodded. Whatever monster she'd seen behind her in that mirror, she didn't care to lay eyes on it again. Whose face had that been, down in the depths of the glass?
Yes, she replied, and she made her voice sound like she meant it.
Rusty built a fire in the stove, and then Josh helped him carry the corpse out to the circus cemetery. Killer yapped along at their heels. And while they were gone, Swan approached the mirror again. It called her, just like the tarot cards had at Leona's. She slowly picked it up, and holding it at arm's length, angled it toward her left shoulder as she had before. But there was no monster face. There was nothing. Swan turned the mirror toward her right. Again, nothing. She missed Leona deeply, and she thought of the devil card in the tarot deck, that face with the awful eye in the center of its head and a mouth that looked like a hallway to hell, had reminded her of the figure on that card.
"Oh, Leona," Swan whispered, "why'd you have to leave us?"
There was a quick red glint in the mirror, just a flash, and then gone. Swan looked over her shoulder. The stove was behind her, and red flames were crackling in the grate. She peered into the mirror again. It was dark, and she realized it was not angled toward the stove after all. A pinpoint of ruby red light flickered and began to grow. Other colors flashed like distant lightning, emerald green, pure white, deep midnight blue. The colors strengthened, merging into a small, pulsating ring of light that Swan at first thought was floating in the air. But in the next moment, she thought she could make out a hazy, indistinct figure holding that ring of light, but she couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. She almost turned around, but didn't, because she knew there was nothing behind her but a wall. No, this sight was only in the magic mirror, but what did it mean? The figure seemed to be walking, wearily but with determination. If as whoever it was knew he or she had a long journey to finish. Swan sensed that the figure was a long way off, maybe not even in the same state. But for a second, she might have been able to make out the facial features, and it might have been the hard-edged face of a woman. Then it went all hazy again, and Swan couldn't tell. The figure seemed to be searching, bearing a ring brighter than firefly lights, and behind her there might have been other searching figures, too. But again, Swan couldn't quite separate them from the mist. The first figure and the glowing circle of many colors began to fade away, and Swan watched until it had dwindled to a point of light like the burning spear of a candle. Then it winked out like a falling star and was gone.
"Come back," she whispered. "Please, come back."
But the vision didn't. Swan aimed the mirror to her left, and behind that shoulder reared a skeletal horse, and on that horse was a rider made of bones and dripping gore, and in his skeleton arms was a scythe that he lifted for a slashing, killing blow. Swan turned. She was all alone, all alone. She was trembling, and she set the mirror glass side down on the desk. She'd had enough magic to last her for a while. "Everything's changed now," she remembered Leona saying. "All that was is gone. Maybe the whole world's just like Sullivan, blowing away, changing, turning into something different than it was before." She needed Leona to help her figure out these new pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, but Leona was gone. Now it was her and Josh, and Rusty Weathers, too, if he decided to go with them to wherever they were headed. But what did the vision in the magic mirror mean, she wondered? Were they things that were going to happen or things that might? She decided to keep the visions to herself until she thought about them some more. She didn't know Rusty Weathers well enough yet, though he seemed okay. When Josh and Rusty returned, Josh asked the other man if they could stay for a few days, share the water and gravy train, and Swan wrinkled her nose, but her belly growled.
"Where do you two figure to be going?" Rusty inquired.
"I don't know yet. We've got a strong-backed horse and the gutsiest damned mutt you ever saw, and I guess we'll keep going until we find a place to stop."
"That could be a long time."
"You don't know what's out there."
"I know what's behind us. What's ahead can't be much worse."
"You hope," Rusty said.
"Yeah."
He glanced at Swan. Protect the child, he thought. He was going to do his damnedest. Not only because he was obeying that commandment, but because he loved the child and would do all in his power to make sure she survived whatever was ahead. And that, he realized, might be like a walk through hell itself.
"I reckon I'll tag along, if you don't mind," Rusty decided. "All I've got are the clothes on my back, my magic jacket, the box, and the mirror. I don't think there's much of a future here, do you?"
"Not much," Josh said.
Rusty looked through a filmy window.
"Lord, I hope I just live long enough to see the sun come out again. And then I'm going to kill myself with cigarettes."
Josh had to laugh, and Rusty cackled too. Swan smiled, but her smile faded fast. She felt a long way from the little girl who'd walked with her mother into Pawpaw Briggs's grocery store. She would be 10 on the 3rd of November, but right now she felt real old, like at least 30, and she didn't know anything about anything, she thought. Before the bad day, her world had been confined to motels and trailers and little cinder block houses. What had the rest of the world been like, she wondered. And now that the bad day had come and gone, what was left?
"The world'll keep turning," Leona had said. "Oh, God gave this world a mighty spin, he did. And he put mighty tough minds and souls in a lot of people, too. People like you, maybe."
She thought of Pawpaw Briggs sitting up and speaking. That was something she hadn't wanted to think about too much. But now she wanted to know what that had meant. She didn't feel special in any way. She just felt tired and beat up and dusty. And when she let her thoughts drift toward her mama, all she wanted to do was break down and cry. But she didn't. Swan wanted to know more about everything, to learn to read better, if books could be found, to ask questions and learn to listen, to learn to think and reason things out. But she never wanted to grow up all the way, because she feared the grown-up world. It was a bully with a flat stomach and a mean mouth who stomped on gardens before they had a chance to grow. "No," Swan decided. "I want to be who I am. And nobody's going to stomp me down. And if they try, they might just get themselves a foot full of stickers." Rusty had been watching the child as he mixed their dinner of dog food. He saw that she was deep in concentration.
"Penny for your thoughts," he said, and he snapped the fingers of his right hand, bringing up between his thumb and forefinger the coin he'd already palmed.
He tossed it to her, and Swan caught it. She saw it wasn't a penny. It was a brass token about the size of a quarter, and it had Rydell Circus written on it above the smiling face of a clown. Swan hesitated, looked at Josh, and then back to Rusty. She decided to say,
"I'm thinking about tomorrow."
And Josh sat with his back against the wall, listening to the shrill whine of the wind and hoping that somehow they would survive the forbidding corridor of tomorrows that stretched ahead of them.
Chapter 46. The Homewood High School gymnasium had become a hospital, and Red Cross and Army personnel had rigged up generators that kept the electricity going. A haggard Red Cross doctor named Eichelbaum
led Sister and Paul Thorson through the maze of people lying on cots and mattresses on the floor. Sister kept the duffel bag at her side. She hadn't gone more than 5 feet from it in the 3 days since their gunshots had been heard by a group of sentries. A hot meal of corn, rice, and steaming coffee had tasted to Sister like gourmet delicacies. She'd gone into a cubicle in a building marked Incoming and had submitted to being stripped by a nurse in a white suit and mask who had run a Geiger counter over her body. The nurse had jumped back 3 feet when the counter's needle almost went off the scale. Sister had been scrubbed with some kind of white grainy powder, but still the counter cackled like a hen in heat. A half dozen more scrubbings brought the reading down to an acceptable level. But when the nurse had said, "We'll have to dispose of this," and reached for the duffel bag, Sister had grabbed her by the back of the neck and asked her if she still liked living. Two Red Cross doctors and a couple of Army officers who looked like Boy Scouts, except for the livid burns across their faces, couldn't pry the bag away from Sister. And finally, Dr. Eichelbaum had thrown up his arms and shouted, "Just scrub the shit out of the damn thing, then." The duffel bag had been scrubbed several times, and the powder had been sprayed liberally over its contents. "You just keep that damn bag closed, lady," Eichelbaum fumed. One side of his face was covered with blue burns, and he had lost the sight in one eye. "If I see you open it once, it goes in the incinerator." Both Sister and Paul Thorson had been given baggy white coveralls. Most of the others wore them, and rubber boots as well, but Eichelbaum informed them that all the anti-radiation footgear had been given out several days before. Dr. Eichelbaum had put a Vaseline-like substance over the burn marks on her face, and he had examined closely a thickened patch of skin just underneath her chin that looked like a scab surrounded by four small, wart-like bumps. He'd found another two warts at the jawline under her left ear, and a seventh right at the fold of her left eye. He told her that about 65% of the survivors bore similar marks, most probably skin cancer, but there was nothing he could do about them. Slicing them off with a scalpel, he'd told her, only made them grow back larger, and he showed her the angry black scab-like mark that was creeping up from the point of his own chin. The most peculiar thing about the marks, he'd said, was that they appeared only on or near the facial area. He hadn't seen any that were below the neck or on a survivor's arms, legs, or any other area of skin exposed to the blasts. The makeshift hospital was full of burn victims, people who had radiation sickness, and people in shock and depression. The worst cases were kept in the school auditorium, Eichelbaum had told her, and their mortality rate was about 99%. Suicide was also a major problem, and as the days passed and people seemed to understand more about the disaster's scope, Dr. Eichelbaum said, the number of people found hanging from trees increased. The day before, Sister had gone to the Homewood Public Library and found the building deserted, most of the books gone, used as fuel in the fires that kept people alive. The shelves had been ripped out, the tables and chairs carried off to be burned. Sister turned down one of the few aisles where shelves of books remained and found herself staring at the anti-radiation footgear of a woman who had climbed up a stepladder and hanged herself from a light fixture. But she'd found what she was looking for amid a pile of encyclopedias, American history books, farmers' almanacs, and other items that had been spared burning. And in it, she'd seen for herself. "Here he is," Dr. Eichelbaum said, weaving through a few last cots to the one where Artie Wisco lay. Artie was sitting up against a pillow, a tray table between his cot and the one to his left, and he was engrossed in playing poker with a young black man whose face was covered with white triangular burns so precise they looked like they'd been stamped on the skin. "Hiya," Artie said, grinning at Sister and Paul as they approached. "Full house." He turned his cards over and the black man said, "Shit, you cheating, man." But he forked over some toothpicks from a pile on his side of the tray. "Look at this." Artie pushed the sheet back and showed them the heavy tape that crisscrossed his ribs. "Robot here wants to play tic-tac-toe on my belly."
Robot?
Sister asked, and the black youth raised a finger to tip an imaginary hat.
How are you doing today? The doctor asked Artie. Did the nurse take your urine sample?
Sure did, Robot said, and he hooted. Little fool's got a cock that'd hang from here to Philly.
There's not much privacy here, Artie explained to Sister, trying to keep his dignity. They have to take the samples in front of God and everybody.
Some of these women round here see what you got, fool. They're going to be praying on their knees, I be telling you.
Oh, jeez, Artie squirmed with embarrassment. Will you shut up?
You look a lot better, Sister offered.
His flesh was no longer gray and sickly, and though his face was a mass of bandages and livid scarlet burn marks, keloids, Dr. Eichelman called them, she even thought he had healthy color in his cheeks.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting handsomer all the time. Gonna look in the mirror one of these days and see Cary Grant staring back.
Ain't no mirrors around here, fool, Robot reminded him. All the mirrors done broke.
Artie's been responding pretty well to the penicillin we've been pumping into him. Thank God we've got the stuff, or most of these people here would be dead from infection, Dr. Eichelbaum said. He's still got a way to go yet before he's out of the woods, but I think he'll be okay.
How about the Buchanan kid and Mona Ramsey? Paul asked.
I'll have to check the list, but I don't think either one of them is critical.
He looked around the gymnasium and shook his head.
There are so many, I can't keep up with them.
His gaze returned to Paul.
If we had the vaccine, I'd put every one of you into rabies shots, but we don't, so I can't. You just better hope none of the wolves out there were rabid, folks.
Hey, Doc, Artie asked, when do you think I can get out of here?
4 or 5 days at the minimum. Why? You planning on going somewhere?
Yeah, Artie replied without hesitation.
Detroit.
The doctor cocked his head so the one good eye was fixed firmly on Artie Wisco.
Detroit, he repeated. I've heard Detroit was one of the first cities hit. I'm sorry, but I don't think there is a Detroit anymore.
Maybe not, but that's where I'm going. That's where my home is and my wife. Geez, I grew up in Detroit. Whether it was hit or not, I've got to go back there and find out what's left.
Probably the same as Philly, Robot said quietly.
Man, there ain't a cinder left in Philly. I have to go home, Artie said, his voice resolute. That's where my wife is. He looked up at Sister. I saw her, you know. I saw her in the glass ring, and she looked just like she did when she was a teenager. Maybe that meant something. Like I had to have the faith to keep going to Detroit, to keep looking for. Maybe I'll find her. And maybe I won't, but I have to go. You're going to go with me, aren't you? Sister paused. Then she smiled faintly and said,
No, Artie, I can't. I've got to go somewhere else.
He frowned.
Where? I've seen something in the glass ring, too, and I've got to go find out what it means. I have to, just like you have to go to Detroit.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about, Dr. Eichelbaum said, but where do you think you're going?
Kansas.
Sister saw the doctor's single eye blink.
A town called Matheson. It's on the Rand McNally Road Atlas.
She had disobeyed the doctor's orders and opened her bag long enough to stuff the road atlas down into it, next to the powder-covered circle of glass.
Do you know how far it is to Kansas? How are you going to get there, walk?
That's right.
You don't seem to understand this situation, the doctor said calmly.
Sister recognized the tone of voice as the way the attendants had addressed the crazy women in the asylum.
The first wave of nuclear missiles hit every major city in this country, he explained. The second wave hit Air Force and naval bases. The third wave hit the smaller cities and rural industries. Then the fourth wave hit every other damn thing that wasn't already burning. From what I've heard,
There's a wasteland east and west of about a 50-mile radius of this point. There's nothing but ruins, dead people, and people who are wishing they were dead. And you want to walk to Kansas? Sure. The radiation would